The City Club of Boise is a nonpartisan forum dedicated to free speech and the open exchange of ideas on issues critical to the Intermountain Northwest. Its motto is, "Things happen when people start talking." You can find information regarding forums, salons, and tours at cityclubofboise.org. The moderator for today's forum is Karen Sander.
Hello and welcome to today's City Club Virtual Conversation. I am Karen Sander, the City Club Board President and today's moderator. This program is being delivered online, so welcome attendees. Please note that you will not have video or audio from your computers. We'll only be hearing from our panelists. I want to welcome our radio listeners who will be joining us at a later date via Boise State Public Radio on KBSX 91.5 and its affiliates through Southern Idaho and Northern Nevada. Today's forum is available for our audience in large because of our City Club partners and sponsors. I would like to take the time to thank a few of these organizations that help us achieve our mission to ensure compelling conversations, engage citizens, and a dynamic community. Our premier sponsor is Northwest Nazarene University and the NNU College of Business. Our annual sponsor is St. Luke's Health System. We also receive support from our forum series sponsors, AARP Idaho, the Bank of Idaho, Climatech Corporation, Echelon Group, Micron, Pacific Source Health Plans, and Small Mine Development. City Club of Boise also receives funding from the Idaho Humanities Council. Thank you to our media partners, which include Boise State Public Radio, 670 KBOI, Idaho Statesman, Idaho Public Television, and our university partners, U of I, Boise State University, and NNU. Many thanks to those of you who support City Club of Boise with your membership or donation during registration. So with that said, I'm going to go ahead and introduce our panelists. And once I've done that, we'll actually be going to a short video. So please have some patience with us as we transition between this platform and the video platform. And I'll get started. So Lace Johnson is originally from Seattle. She has been in the archival profession since 2013 and is a former employee of the British Museum. She holds a Master of Arts in Biblical Studies from King's College London, is a certified archivist and a graduate of the Western Archives Institute. Today, she is the collection archivist at the Idaho State Archives and recent recipient of the Council of State Archivists Ancestry Leadership Award for the Idaho State Constitution Conservation Project. That's a mouthful. So, Bill Manny, a former president of Boise City Club, as a writer and producer for Idaho Public Television, grew up in Oregon and is a veteran newspaper editor and writer who spent 5 years reporting from Washington, D.C. and 18 years at the Idaho Statesman. So with that said, I am going to turn it over so that we can kick it off with this little video snip and then we'll get into the meat of our program here.
You can see that our Constitution needs a little tender, loving care.
Things like the Declaration of Independence, the Utah and Idaho state constitutions, it's really important that they survive through the ages.
Oh my goodness, this is truly an historic moment.
Maintaining that history, if we let it slip through, history will not speak well of us.
The Idaho Constitution. After 130 years, its pages are loose and obscured by decades of grime. And yet this worn and torn document is what sparked Idaho's statehood, created our government, and guaranteed our rights.
It's an experiment in self-government. Nothing is in concrete in a democracy. Whenever I hear this, these are dead documents, I'm like, what are you talking about? Because this is what we're doing right now, today. This is the way we set the rules of the road.
The Constitution expressed our state's highest ideals and some of its darkest impulses.
Their ancestors in this state were thrown in prison because of their religious beliefs. And very few people today understand that.
After all these decades, some mysteries remain. How could this inspiring charter of freedoms deny so many Idahoans basic rights? Can these worn and torn pages even be saved?
The only way to deal with that is to just test it. So you test and test until you're sure that you can go ahead with this entire procedure.
And one of the biggest mysteries of all, who set pen to paper to record the words that created our state?
Unfortunately, we do not know who drafted the Constitution. That is a question we get asked often, and we wish we knew.
What will we reveal about our state and ourselves as Idaho's Constitution is revealed? Find out on Idaho Experience.
Thank you. So just a quick reminder to our radio listeners, you're listening to City Club of Boise Virtual Conversations about the restoration of Idaho's Constitution, featuring Lace Johnson, collection archivist at the Idaho State Archives, and Bill Manny, producer, Idaho Public Television. These links will be available to you so you can see these videos. But with that, Bill, I'm just going to launch it right here. Tell us about that clip.
That's a quick overview of the whole show. We started in October. Lace put the document on an airplane with Governor Little and flew down with Governor Little and First Lady Teresa Little, delivered the Idaho Constitution to Governor Herbert at the University of Utah. And so it was a ceremonial passing of the torch, so to speak. It was the first time the Idaho Constitution, to any of our knowledge, has ever been out of the state. Also the first time it has ever been side by side with the Utah Constitution. They were both in the conservation lab at the same time, sitting on the same table side by side. You got to meet book conservator Stacy May Kelly, the woman who actually did the work on the document. You got to hear from federal judge Stephen Trott, who was just so passionate and articulate about the fragility of our democracy. You got to hear from Stephen Kenyon, who is an LDS historian. He's a well-known guy here in town, but he's also an amateur historian who's done a lot of research into discrimination against the Mormons at the time of the Constitution. And then lastly, you got to hear from Danielle Grindel, who is the photo archivist and so helpful to all of us scholars and wannabe scholars as we're trying to find photos to illustrate our stories. And so that really kind of summarized the whole show.
Great. Thank you, Bill. So, Lace, why don't we start at the beginning? How did this project and documentary all come about?
Gosh, it seems like a very long road. When I started here at the Idaho State Archives, it was back in 2013, and my predecessor, Michael Davidson, who is the collections archivist before I took her role, had been in early conversations with Randy Silverman at the University of Utah about the Constitution. She ended up leaving and taking a job in the private sector, and we knew that this was something that we wanted to do, but we also had our Idaho State Museum that was in the midst of being built and opening, and so we kind of sidebarred it and kind of kept it in the back of our minds while we were working towards that project. But it was the first fundraising event we've had with the Wynate Stone Artifacts event with the Foundation for Idaho History that I recall since my time here of doing something for the archives from our collections here. And so it was a really wonderful opportunity because, of course, it is the most important document we house at the Idaho State Archives. It gives us our rights. It's our founding document for the state of Idaho. So it was really crucial to preserve it and make sure that future generations have access to it as well. So that's a little bit of the backstory. But that fundraising event happened a year before we actually delivered the document to the lab. And so it was quite a long process, planning process. And thankfully, Idaho Public Television wanted to document our journey. So that was really a great partnership.
That's a great segue. Bill, tell us a little bit about how Idaho Public Television came to get involved. I'm assuming you jumped at this opportunity because it's so unique.
We jumped with both feet. Lace and her colleagues came to us with the idea of following the process from start to finish, and it sounded intriguing at the time. And the more we found out about the work that needed to be done, the mysteries that we might be able to answer. It became a really intriguing project. I've been in journalism my entire life, and I can't remember a story I worked on that was so multifaceted and so all-consuming. You had, history, you had the territorial history, you have statehood history, you have human rights, you have voting rights, you have the trend up till today, how the Constitution is affecting rulings in our courts, in our legislature, up until the last legislature. Then you had the whole physical story. We actually got to see the document. We got to watch Lace carry it on an airplane. We got to watch it be delivered to Utah. And then we got to see them take it apart and actually go to work on this really fragile document. We got to meet this really cool book restorer called Mark Anderson, who came up to do the binding and the new leather cover. We got to meet some really cool people at the University of Utah who are passionate about what they do in conserving books. And we got to learn about science. We got to learn about how you can make the most powerful glue out of wheat starch, which are book binding techniques that are as old as books and are still being used today. So it just had a little bit of everything, and it was endlessly fascinating, and it continues to fascinate me up till today.
That's great. So it sounds pretty complicated, and it sounds like it involves a lot of people and processes. So Lace, why don't you just tell us a little bit about, what that process looked like? And this is more than just preserving a piece of history. It's more than that.
Yeah, definitely. There were so many questions. It really started with a series of questions in the beginning of what I could and could not do. One of the avenues I had to take in the beginning was to try and exhaust all ideas of keeping the document in the state, and if we had any paper conservators and book conservators in the state, because anytime you move something out of your custody, there's risk involved. And so I exhausted all those avenues and realized that, unfortunately, at this time, maybe that'll change. But at this time, Idaho doesn't have a preservation lab like the University of Utah does. And I had done some previous work with Randy Silverman. He came up to do some disaster recovery trainings with our staff. And so we already had a relationship developed. So I contacted him. I knew that Michael had worked with him in the past and sort of early talks about this. And he was still up for the challenge. So he flew out with Stacy, the art and paper conservator, and she came to do some preliminary tests. They took very tiny samples off of pages that didn't have any writing on it, just to see what the paper consistency was, the lines and the inks. So they were checking, what the solubility was for some of the lines on the papers, and they were doing some early tests to try and figure out if it was something they could accomplish. The biggest challenge was two of our pages were laminated, which was an early conservation technique that had failed, and we realize now today it was not the best technique. So that was one of the early challenges. So I was working with risk management. We were working with lawyers from the University of Utah, insurance, travel, figuring out all these logistics. So even just the logistics part of getting the thing down there was part of the challenge. And then, of course, trying to time it where everyone would be available. And we had some roadblocks early on of contracts and delays. And so it's crazy to me now, because, of course, we're in a pandemic. We got the Constitution back just a month before everything shut down. So I'm just amazed that it worked out that way. That was my biggest concern while it was down there, was getting it home safely once the work had been done.
Hey, Karn, if I could jump in, we have a clip that talks about the challenges that archivists face. And I know that Lace has talked about how when we think about history and preserving history, we often think about museums. And yet there's a whole lot more than just museums that go into it. So maybe she could talk a little bit about that, and we could watch that clip.
Absolutely.
Yeah, sometimes archivists, because they're back in the vaults working with paper, we're kind of like the quiet, the people in the caves, behind the scenes working. But really, archives are foundational for government. They're foundational in the history profession. If you write a history book, you depend on us to do your research. If you make a documentary about history, you depend on us for your research. And if you build a museum, you depend on us for your research. So we're kind of that foundational piece of history. We store the items that people use to do their research and those primary sources. So that's a little bit about what archivists do, but we're constantly balancing access and preservation because sometimes they don't always go together. And the more you handle records, the more susceptible they are to damage. But the whole reason we exist is to provide access. So we're always kind of balancing those two things. And then, of course, along those lines, we have conservators and preservation specialists that help us to do just those things. So without further ado, let's do this.
Let's go to the next clip.
These archivists and conservators usually work behind the scenes.
My big dream in this project was to expose who archivists are and what we do. That archivists play a role in protecting the state's history, that because we're able to house these government records, that holds our government accountable and honest. We also are collecting donated records of businesses and nonprofits and family papers and diaries and photography collections, that we're really collecting the state's history in its entirety.
So interesting. You know, you touched a little bit, Lace, on, you know, the challenge with the laminated pages, but maybe, Bill, you can touch on a little bit about the work you did with University of Idaho during this process, and I think we've got another clip that we'll go to after that.
We couldn't be in Utah for, you know, four entire months, and we didn't need to be because we were able to go to the lab at the University of Utah at critical moments to film the process. But they also had their own staff videographer, photographer Tony, who documented some of those steps for us. And so between the work he did and the work we did, we were able to follow the process almost from start to finish. But the real expert on well, if there's an expert, it's kind of a mysterious process why they laminated these pages in the 60s. But Lace is probably the person to talk about kind of what we confronted, what we as a state confronted in making that decision.
Great. Lace, if you could touch on that.
Yeah, so about the mid 20th century, it became very popular to laminate records and everyone was doing it. The National Archives, the Library of Congress, it was worldwide. This was the it thing in conservation to do for paper records. By the 1970s, it had gone out of fashion because they had realized that it actually did much more harm to documents than leaving it alone and providing a healthy enough environment. So I believe in the 1950s, they had caught on to acid. So if you had acidic paper that you trapped between two sheets of cellulose acetate, it actually increased the rapid deterioration of that paper by being laminated. So in the 50s, they started delaminating things and deacidifying both the plastic as well as the paper. And it looks very different than when we think lamination, we think of what we're familiar with of just, it's similar in process, but it doesn't have the same look to it. It's sort of this, it ended up having sort of a foggy look because they would line it with Japanese tissue as well to try and protect the document. So it was really hard to read. It wasn't as legible as now once they were able to delaminate it. You could get a really clear image of the ink. And that was one of the big challenges was this would have to be submerged. And we needed to know that the ink wasn't going to run because if it got delaminated, but we can't read it anymore because the ink ran, then there's no point to doing that either. So they did an immense amount of testing before they even tried anything and made their recommendations. And I had to really sit on this long and hard to come to a consensus. I sat down with the state archivist, David Maddy, and our administrator, Janet Gallimore, our director, to really figure out, is this going to be a good decision? And we went forward with it. And thankfully, it was the right decision to make, but it was not an easy one.
You know, we've got a clip to show on this, so I think we'll go right to that because I think it'll show a little bit about this process.
6 weeks after Governor Little delivered the Constitution to Utah, it was decision time.
The document would be best served if we went forward with the delamination. It was worth the risk to preserve it.
The lamination is inside the pores of the paper. So even though I might peel off this film that comes off in the first bath, it takes many, many baths to get all of the residue out of the page. I have tweezers and a spatula, and it's almost like, you know, like a little operation where you hold one side down and you just slowly get this laminate, and you see it come right off, like one whole layer. The way I know that the residue is gone is that I collect all of the solvent that I used in the bath and I let it evaporate, and I can see if there's any residue left inside the bath. So I think it was like prudent to go ahead, but I think the results are much better than what we expected.
I am so happy. It's so legible and easier to read. I was worried about the opposite happening.
And so when the lamination was actually removed, the page separated into 3 or 4 pieces because that was the only thing holding it together. To see how different it looks from the original when we first got it is very rewarding.
Gosh, that's just fascinating. And so, you know, I love seeing that. And, you know, this leads into Bill, what were the biggest surprises for you?
Well, just watching that clip, I'm surprised again at, you know, Lace sounds pretty kind of blasé about it today, but she was a nervous wreck in the days and weeks leading up to that. They didn't know if they were going to actually, I mean, they put this 130-year-old paper into a bath of acetone. And so it's a pretty, turns out, not so risky process, but we didn't know that at the time. So so just understanding of the chemistry and the decision-making process was one of the surprises. The biggest surprise for me as kind of a newcomer to this was in 1889, when the Idaho Constitution was written, we as a state and most of the Western states were in this real battle against the LDS Church. And so then congressional delegate Fred T. Du Bois and other leaders were virulently anti-Mormon, and they were doing everything they possibly could to make sure that the Mormons did not exercise influence over these states as their population was growing. And so Arizona, Utah, Idaho for sure were real hotbeds, and this debate over LDS rights was also happening in Congress. And so for Idaho to become a state, the delegates to the Constitution needed to demonstrate to Congress that they weren't going to brook any abuse by these Mormon upstarts. Mm-hmm. And so even before the Constitution was written in 1889, the Idaho Territorial Legislature had passed a law that essentially denied members of the LDS Church the right to vote, to hold public office. And that language was enshrined in the Constitution. And so for 4, 5, 6, 7 years up until after statehood, members of the LDS Church could not vote in Idaho and could not hold elected office or appointed office. And in fact, we're still being sent to prison for polygamy and for lying about whether they were members of the church. And so, you know, in this moment when we talk about voting rights and citizenship rights, you know, Idaho was born as a state that denied so many of the people who lived here, not just Mormons, but Indians and people of Chinese descent as well, the right to vote. And so this was a real moment for me to realize that when we talk about rights and discrimination, this is something that we've had to wrestle with as a state and a country since our very beginning. Stephen Kenyon and John Dinger, two lawyers here in Boise who are amateur historians, have really studied this issue, and we interviewed both of them and really elucidated this chapter in Idaho history. I guess the postscript to the story is that former Boise mayor Peter J. Pefley stood up against the vast majority of the congressional delegates in 1889 and opposed this anti-Mormon language and spoke against it when it came time to vote to support the entire document. He said he couldn't support it because it did not guarantee religious rights to everybody. In fact, one of the other members of the congressional convention was so upset that he said that if anybody like Peter Pefley wasn't going to sign the Constitution, he shouldn't get his pay for having been there for a month. And Peter Pefley said, "You can take your money. I don't want it if that's the cost." And so here's a man who really stood up in 1889 for the rights of minorities. He was a Presbyterian. He wasn't a Mormon. And his story really deserves to be told. And Steve Kenyon does a really good job of helping us tell that story. Peter Pefley ended up having business setbacks after that. He was a wealthy harness maker and mayor of Boise in the 1880s. He ended up moving to Lewiston, where he died kind of a unknown and penniless. And so him standing up for the rights of minorities cost him financially and socially, and he was willing to do it anyway. So that's just one of the interesting characters that emerge in the story.
That's great. And then, you know, Liz, maybe you can talk a little bit about, you know, I think you mentioned it, but who actually put pen to paper to write the document? I think that's one of the other, you know, who was the scribe?
Oh, I don't know. That's really Bill's baby. He's the one who made the big discovery and went down that path. But that's exactly the question I was wondering at the very beginning of this, because often when we would put the Constitution on display for different people coming through the archives, we would get asked that, who wrote it, meaning who scribed it. And we really didn't know. And when we approached Idaho Public Television in the first meeting with Bill, we mentioned that was one of our mysteries. And he was like, "Oh, I'll figure it out," in sort of a nonchalant way. And he really did. He's our little history detective. So yeah, I'll let him tell that story, because he worked really hard on it. And it was really exciting to see him go through that process.
Bill.
Well, I now consider myself a history mystery expert. Actually, it was not just me. Both Danielle and Lace helped me look at the documents. What's interesting about this story is there's these boxes of documents from around the time from the actual Constitutional Convention that really have not been studied by historians. And they really haven't had to study these documents, because there is a word-for-word transcript of the entire convention. It's 2,000 pages, two thick volumes. And so for anybody who really wants to understand the time and the mood and what happened, you have the words of the delegates right there. And so that's really a terrific resource for historians and scholars. So you have these boxes on which some of this other stuff is based, but it's not as important to the historians. But it's important. It's important to me as a kind of a treasure hunter, and it was important to me as a filmmaker looking for, you know, tactile things we could show. And so we went through these boxes of territorial and convention documents, probably in a methodical way that other people haven't. And so as we were going through these documents, in the bottom of one of these boxes, there's a big manila envelope, and I turned it open, and out fell all the little place cards that all the delegates, I assume all the delegates had put at their desks, and had their name and their home county. So you could see the handwriting of every single delegate. And I got to thinking, well, here are handwriting samples from all the delegates, not just their signatures on the actual constitution. So we went through all those, and none of that handwriting matched the writing of the in the Constitution. But there are some distinctive letters in that in the Constitution. It's not very fancy. There were fancier writers and prettier writers. This is very kind of utilitarian handwriting for the day, but there are some unique letters. And so as we continue to go through the boxes of documents, there are all the payments to the Constitutional Convention delegates. They had to sign their names to get their pay. And so there's handwriting from all the delegates, but all of the staff also had to sign their names in order to get their pay. And so we were able to look at the signatures for all the delegates. And one of them had an S and a J that looked like the S and the J from the Constitution. So that staffer's name was John Curtis. And so a little bit of research, including from some help from Judy Austin, who is a retired state historian, turned out that John Curtis had worked for Governor Shoup. And so we went through the Governor Shoup records, assuming that if somebody is the secretary to the governor, some handwriting sample would exist. Well, we struck out there. He was also secretary to Territorial Governor McConnell, or Governor McConnell. We struck out there. But in continuing to search, we found a letter from John J. Curtis to one of the territorial judges, some routine material where he's said, here, we've included a copy of the document you requested, yours sincerely, John D. Curtis, and we have his signature and his handwriting. And it looked to me like a perfect match. So I took it to Lace and I said, I think we've solved the mystery. And she agreed, but we are not experts. And so we were able to get Philip Stoffel, who is a handwriting analyst for the Ada County Sheriff's Office, who had just retired the week I called him, who said, sure, I have some time on my hands. And so he came in and looked at the documents and took them home and then put his stamp of approval and said, yes, this guy, John J. Curtis, did write the Idaho Constitution. So that's a long story.
Now an investigator, and I believe we have another clip on this, so video clip. Yes. So I think we'll segue to that.
In the Idaho State Archives are boxes full of convention and statehood records. And the verbatim account of the 1889 convention itself runs to more than 2,000 pages.
So we know where they got their paper from, where they got their tumblers from, and where their ice came from. One would assume that the person who was assigned to draft the Constitution would also be in those records, but it was a secret for some reason, or it seemed to be.
This was one of the biggest mysteries, was who wrote the Constitution, because that is the most popular question we get. And of course, you know, the delegates together, collectively, wrote it, but who actually scribed the document?
The handwriting in the Constitution matches none of the delegates' signatures. But one convention record offered an intriguing lead.
We have Hattie Harris, who's the assistant grossing clerk, John J. Curtis, who's the enrolling clerk. So with Idaho Public Television's help, we pulled the manuscript collections of different judges and senators to then start comparing handwriting.
To render a verdict, the Historical Society and Idaho Public Television needed a detective. Enter Philip Stoffel, a just-retired lieutenant with the Ada County Sheriff's Office.
All the different things that we look at when we're doing question document examinations and comparisons, how the letters are formed, how the letters connect to their fellow letters, spacing in between letters, slant. Five lines right here, but it's giving us a lot of characteristics to compare to the known writings of John J. Curtis.
John J. Curtis. For a job that required speed and trustworthiness, Curtis was a good choice. He was the son of the territorial secretary, Edward J. Curtis. His older brother served in the same territorial post. John J. Curtis worked as a trusted aide to governors, congressmen, and senators in Washington, D.C.
He's this unknown man that we didn't know much about until we started delving into this project. Had it not been our partnership with Idaho Public Television, we would never have figured out this question and have an answer to share with the public.
What became of John J. Curtis? Born in Boise in 1868, he went to work for the War Department in the early 1900s, and then the Department of Agriculture in Washington. When he died in 1937, he left a widow but no children. He's not buried with the other Curtises in Boise's Pioneer Cemetery. In the end, this eyewitness to Idaho history remains a mystery to the state he helped create.
So just a reminder to our radio listeners, you're listening to City Club of Boise virtual conversation about the restoration of Idaho's Constitution, featuring Lace Johnson, collections archivist, Idaho State Archives, and Bill Manny, producer, Idaho Public Television. So, you know, that's it's a mystery still. So why do we know so little about this John J. Curtis? And what have we learned about him since?
That's a really good question. We should know more about this guy. He was the son of the longtime territorial secretary, Edward J. Curtis, who was kind of the Pete Santarusa of his day, right? He was essentially the secretary of state for Idaho Territory from the 1860s through the 1880s. And all his sons, he had three or four sons, all of whom worked in his office at the time. And so when Idaho had a whole bunch of really crazy territorial governors, most of whom were inept if they even showed up in the state. So Edward Curtis was acting governor longer than any of the real governors. And so very prominent character in Idaho territorial politics. His oldest son, Edward L. Curtis, served in the same position and was very well beloved, died early of a sickness. And so then John J. Curtis served his father, served the territorial governors, served the first governors after statehood, served the first senator and the first congressman. So he served five or six of the most critical early Idaho political figures, Shoup and McConnell and Hayburn and Sweet and Du Bois. He was either their personal secretary or their chief of staff, and in many cases, a good friend. And so here's a man who was a witness to the birth of our state, and we know almost nothing about him. He goes to work in Washington, D.C. for Willis Sweet when he's one of the first congressmen. At some point, John J. Curtis stays in Washington, D.C. He goes to work as a stenographer for the War Department. There was no Pentagon then, right? So he's working in the War Department. He never returns to Idaho. We don't know anything about him for the next 30 years. Interestingly, in the 1930s, retired Congressman Addison Smith, who is apparently a good friend with John J. Curtis, asks John J. Curtis to write a series of stories for the Idaho Statesman. And so in the 1930s, we have this remarkable series of articles about Shoup and McConnell and Hayburn and Sweet and Du Bois written by John J. Curtis, kind of an eyewitness to history thing. And he writes about all these other characters, but he writes almost nothing about himself. So even though he was so integral to the early days of Idaho statehood and the last days of Idaho Territory, we know almost nothing about him. What we do know, we can kind of tease out, you know, from references and little mentions here and there. You know, he was born in Boise. He grew up in Boise. The Edward Curtis had a home at Main and Fifth, where Capitol Cellars now stands. You know, he grew up in political Idaho. He grew up a couple blocks from the territorial capital. He was downtown. He was friends or colleagues or confidants to almost every early critical Idaho political figure. And so I'm hoping to find out more about it. We know of two photographs, one taken in the 1930s when he's an old man, and a really blurry photo of him on a camping trip with Fred Du Bois on Henry's Fork right after the Constitutional Convention in 1889. That's all we have of this guy.
Yeah, he's a really behind the scenes kind of person for sure. So,
absolutely.
Yeah, you know, and this is a great segue. You know, how do you tell the story that's 150 years old? I mean, you cannot go back and interview folks. So, you know, how do you track this down? Where are you searching, and who are you talking to?
Yeah, there were no video cameras in 1889.
And no social media either.
I want to give a shameless plug to why archives are so important. because this is exactly the issue. If these records are not saved, then these people, you know, they keep being more and more mysterious. Donating family collections, donating organizational records, making donations of your own personal histories is so critical to archives. The way that we operate, we have our government records side, which of course is where the constitutional records stay. But a lot of these questions that Bill was grappling with was actually on our donated collections side, our manuscript collections. And although they're not considered government records because they weren't produced while working for a government agency, they told the stories of these people that were in government. And so they're the other side of the story that oftentimes people keep those types of records in their own family with their own family and pass it down generations. But if you do have a family and you have historical records and you don't have a keeper in your own family that cares about these things, really consider donating to an archives, because it may not make sense to you how important or how critical your collection is, but it may make sense to somebody else. So this is a very good example of why archives exist and why they're critical to understand ourselves, our society, where we are now today. And it really brings context to our lives.
Yeah.
So what we know about Peter Pefley really all came through his family. There was a family memoir that his daughter wrote that was donated. There's a family photo album in the archives. And so we know a relatively lot about Pefley because the family preserved all that material and it ended up at the Historical Society. There's a lot of material on William Borah, some of which is governmental and some of which is family as well. A lot of these other characters, there's just very little known. You would think we know a lot about Edward Curtis and John J. Curtis, but I have not been able to find anywhere that their papers reside. So the challenge of making a history documentary, you can't just go out and interview. You know, I'm jealous of my colleagues down the hall here at Outdoor Idaho. They get to go out to the Sawtooths, you know, shoot beautiful scenery, interview hikers and fishermen and hunters, and they have a show, right? Well, when you're doing a history documentary, how do you show something that was never photographed or barely photographed?
Yeah.
We drove Danielle crazy at the archives because I was constantly asking, well, do we have any photos from the territorial days? Do we have any photos from the convention? And there's not a single photo that we know of from that 1889 convention. And there were 69 delegates here for a month in Boise. One would think that there'd be some photo record of that event. It was such a monumental thing, but there's no photograph. But I know that I'll make this pitch for Danielle. If there's somebody sitting on a treasure trove of photos, we are lucky that we have this. We have these kind of boxes of kind of newly discovered or newly researched documents from the convention. It was really cool going through those. You can see where John Limp, another Boise mayor, sold ice to the convention delegates so they could have something cool to drink. They had to water the streets to keep down the dust around the territorial capital. So there's these records of, you know, the pencils and the erasers and the paper and the spittoons and the paper holders and the pencil holders. There's all these records that kind of help us tell that story in lieu of, you know, videotape or photos or eyewitness accounts.
That's so interesting. So we've had a question from the audience, and this kind of ties in, you know, talking about this project also produced a replica, but we've got a question about digitizing. So maybe, Lace, can you tell us a little bit about why a replica was produced, how it was done, and then, you know, maybe talk about digitizing.
So it's interesting. Digitizing is all the rage right now, specifically because of the pandemic, but has been heading that direction thanks to big companies like Google that has provided a lot of information through Google Books. HathiTrust.org also has a lot of materials from out-of-print books that they provide to the public. So the one thing that is really challenging from the archives perspective when it comes to digitization is that the size of these files, in order to have them be produced at a quality that someone can see and read, can be quite large when you talk about preservation size files, as well as the access files. And so all of these things take a lot of time and space requirements. So unfortunately, right now, we do not have a digital archivist on staff. And we are currently on the cusp of really having to grapple with these issues of digitally born records as well. So when we look at digitization projects, we are looking at things that people need to access or want to access. We look at preservation issues. Does it require a lot of handling, and is the preservation a concern? Maybe the items are glass plate negatives and we really don't want to pull them too much, and they are at risk for damage, or maybe they're nitrate and they're volatile and they need to be in freezer storage, so we want to make sure those get digitized. And one of our big things is our magnetic media, so our audio cassettes with all of our oral histories. It's a dying thing, because the information loss of magnetic audio strips, both in VHS and audio cassettes, it's rapidly losing information. And then, of course, the obsolescence of equipment. And so we both are working on digitizing items that are at risk or are moving image collection. And we're also trying to grapple with digitally born materials as well. And like archival storage, so when you think of traditional archival storage for paper, for film, for photographic materials, you're looking at temperature requirements, humidity controls, mitigating light damage. So you're looking at an environment more than anything else. It's the most important thing to protect materials is environment. Similarly, digital materials require environmental controls, but of digital nature. And when you have bit rot, when you have corrupt files, when you have obsolescence of softwares that you're dependent upon, if you try and put in a floppy disk, you can't even get a CD-ROM on a laptop anymore. So these things that are just rapidly changing, technology is rapidly changing. The state archivist, I can't remember if she's still in California or not, but the former California state archivist that I met several years back, she compared digital records as two-year-olds that you can't keep your eyes off of. You got to keep on them because of the rapid change. So when we look at digitizing, it's not just scanning and just sticking it somewhere. You have to create metadata so that it's searchable, so that it makes sense. You have to also create a context within the archival structure. So we're following our standards, which is DAX, Describing Archives of Content Standard. It's the way that we describe collections so that finding aids make sense to researchers and they look the same no matter what archives you go to. Electronic records have to be maintained in that same way. So it's it's really an interesting time where we're trying to preserve items and make them more accessible through our website and try and highlight those records. But it's really always going to be a sample of what we have. There is just no darn way to ever digitize everything in our holdings. Now, the Constitution, because we created a replica, they at the University of Utah, they have a digitization lab, and Michelle there had imaged every single page of the Constitution at a high resolution. It was so big that it was so cumbersome on even our system once she was done to store it. And so when we put it on our website, we had to make those files much smaller so that they would load and they'd be accessible on, through our website. But that's the second time our Constitution was imaged. It was imaged by a Boise photographer previously. But those original electronic records that had been photographed became corrupt and no one could open them. And so we had this one that we had printed out where people would be access it that way, a replica, a really sad replica, but an access copy. And we had to create a PDF from the access copy to put that online until we were able to have it imaged. And that's just one example of something going terribly wrong where you invest in having the work done, but that file was not maintained. And so then all of a sudden, when you go to use it, it's corrupt and you can't use it. So it's very complicated. And I wish we were in a situation where we had a digital program that was very robust. So I'll do another plug. Donate stuff and money. No, just kidding. But it's quite expensive. And it's its own ball of wax. It's like its own, you know, same problems, just different format.
Yeah, we have a number of questions related to that. You know, you've got the replica, but how is this being shared with students, number one? Can you see this at the archives? And, you know, outside of the, you know, the digitized version, is the actual document available for view?
All great questions. In our past life before the pandemic, we had spent a lot of hours developing exactly that, a traveling exhibit where we were going to be sending the replica out to the communities. We're working with the Commission for Libraries to do just that, to make sure that the communities throughout Idaho had access to that exhibit and to see the replica. Bill and I were going to do our tour together of the documentary and have panel discussions. And we actually did have the Constitution on display for, I don't know, a week before everything got shut down. So it just hit us at a really complicated time. So all those plans are not gone. They're just on pause at the moment. And so, you know, we hope that that is something that we are able to do. With regards to the Constitution itself, the original being on display rather than the replica, it's really tricky because light damage handling, anytime you have it on display, there's risk involved for deterioration. So that's why the replica is so crucial for us to be able to have it on display. And they did such a fantastic job because it's really in the same feel. They even took the width of the paper to make sure the consistency and the look and the feel of the paper was as close as they could come. They did so many different color corrections and making sure that it has the right look to it. And then the binding is almost identical to the new binding. So the cover looks beautiful. So it really is the best replica that you could ask for. But the original will only be brought out for limited times and for special occasions. Once it's on display for a certain amount of time, it has to be in dark storage for several years before it can go on display again because of light damage.
Can I just say that our documentary and the work on the Constitution will become part of Idaho Public Television's learning media, and we do work with Idaho school teachers to develop curriculum based on all the Idaho experience documentaries, and so that will be available to teachers when and if we all get back to normal.
Yes, definitely. We're looking forward to that. So, you know, this is a segue into, you know, looking back and then looking forward. When the signers, you know, signed this original document, were there any special inks available or papers at that time? Were they even thinking about preservation? And then a follow-up to that is, who's recording, you know, today, the legislature today, and are they thinking about preservation for the future? So kind of a look back and a look forward. So maybe Lace, you can tackle that.
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't think any time people are in the moment of developing these things, they're thinking of the future and what it may bring. And that was true of that era, and it's true today. Oftentimes, archives and archivists are called at the very last minute and handed things off after the fact. And so when we have the opportunity, which occasionally we do, but when we have the opportunity to be participatory in the discussion, that makes things a lot easier to guide in terms of giving an idea of how things may come to an archives and how they can be preserved better. But oftentimes we're not top on the mind because we're the history people. We're in history world, not in the now. So sometimes we're forgotten to be a part of that discussion. So we, particularly with digitally born records, because softwares are oftentimes proprietary. So when you're thinking about future access to things, if that company goes under or just doesn't make the product any longer, and you have to have that software in order to open the file, these things become very problematic. So I think the age that we're living in from the archives perspective is so much more challenging when it comes to preservation. Now for access, it's fantastic. It is such a nice age to be alive in order for, you know, you to access things in a really quick and easy way. But the long-term preservation is sort of a nightmare. Back in the day, it appears that they used the paper that was available to them. Okay. They were, you know, out west in a territory that was very rugged, and they used lined paper that just appears like standard, you know, issued paper of the time. And you go through the list and of items that they were purchasing, and it's adorable, the stationery and the, you know, and the pencils and the rubber bands and it's just really, it makes it so human to see that side of it, that they're just trying to get a job done.
Want to give you a heads up, we are almost at time, so Bill, maybe wrap it up.
I was just going to say, when you read the transcript, they are not thinking about the future. They are urging that scribe to finish the document so they can poke holes through it, tie it together with a ribbon, and sign it and be done. So this was all about getting done and becoming a state. They were not thinking about 2020 and what the City Club or Idaho Public Television wanted to do with that document.
Oh my gosh. So, you know, great segue here. I want to thank you both. We've been listening to Lace Johnson, Collection Archivist, Idaho State Archives. You know, Bill, this is on Idaho Public Television under shows Idaho Experience. So thank you both so much. This has been fascinating, and I know we could chat for many hours more. So I sure appreciate your participation in this program. Thank you, everybody.
You've been listening to the City Club of Boise. The next virtual forum will welcome Bob Maynard, the Chief Investment Officer for PERSI, the Public Employee Retirement System of Idaho. That forum on Wednesday, the 26th of August at noon. Register for this and other forums, learn about becoming a member, and see a schedule of coming events at cityclubofboise.org. Or by calling 208-364-4614. And you can connect on Facebook and Twitter by searching for City Club of Boise.